My name is Aaron Jetty, and I was brought in by Daniel Muscat here to talk about some kashrut related issues. He thinks he brought me to speak about kashrut issues. I really came to market by saying it. But I have two topics over here that I want to talk about. One is going to be related. Good? Yep. Two topics I want to speak about. One is related to Amos, and the other is related to Shittings. We're going to start off with and as we go along, anybody who has any questions is free to interject. I want to explain today the concept of we see our packages called gluttony, excessivity. Where did that come from? What exactly that means? But in order to really explain the concept of excessivity, I really have to go back all the way back to the 3,000 years ago, give an explanation of what exactly degenerate is and where it started. In my discussion over here at the introduction, there's two topics that I really need to explain well. One topic is that the behaviors are getting worse. This is going to give you an understanding of HSVs. And the other topic is that Judaism is polarizing. What does it mean the behaviors are getting worse? So if you did it in Gemara, we learned out that rough behaviors are sheres. How do we know the rough behaviors are sheres? We know from Parvatis. There was many Parvatis in which it was not possible to check for Dreyfus, Asir, Mishalea, Korban Oyla, things that were burnt. And we know from a Mishnah that a Korban is straight as possible. And nevertheless, the times of basic leaders are often for months without checking phrases. That's the need of the Gemara, and that's the call of the need that the Gemara brings out. In the first place where it's mentioned is where there's a remiss that they're checking for phrases, there's a Gemara Beitza. The Gemara Beitza talks about the Gemara brings a lesson to the team of Katea Rabbeinu of Kassav and Kheens. Kasev is Mimar to meet the meat with a solid meat before he checks the lung, it's going to be a tie-in. The Gemara itself, the way the before she learned it, the way Tosis learned it, it's not talking about a pain because the race is just talking about their heirs. Their heirs, you shouldn't be in a rush to meet meat before you check the lung. It was definitely not a chiyuv. Later we see a Midrash Tanakhuma that says the person was, the Midrash is trying to compare our generation, their generation to Adorisha, that Adorisha didn't have any options. He had many options, he could have had food, and he specifically picked this one he shouldn't eat, as opposed to us, we only have one Ava, and he could become straight, a person will check one, he's not going to eat it. That's the Midrash. In explanation of those Gemaras, the Meiri clearly says that in the days of Chazal, they were not looking to check lungs. It was at the Kanzagoyim. The whole concept of checking lungs was, according to the Meiri, was started in the Zmanagoyim. There's a Mordechai, it was the exact same line. The days of Chazal, they're not checking lungs. There's also a Ubud Zed. There are some Rishonim that says that even though they're not obligated, that was permitted to do it. There's a Rambam. A Rambam is very clear, says the minute when he's thrown was to check lungs. There's late other Rishonim which are coming later, let's say a tour, a run, a rebush, that says there was an obligation to check lungs. And this Machlokes is also very much negated in the Parvatis, where they check the lungs in Parvatis. Again, there's a Rebush says they were, and the Rush says they clearly were. But nobody was. Even according to these opinions, that there was a minute to check lungs, or that there was later showing that there was an obligation to one, The get of checking the lung was a huge rabbanit. Everybody supported that because it was a mutar matzah. It was common, it was shir, but not a rov, it was shir to find treifas. In Rishon's time, we find that there was times when the people were shut animals and they saw the rov was for treifas. There's a Baldi who says like that. There's that we discussed about 9-10 years ago about how people are drinking milk today. We're not going to go into that topic because the dairy cows are also in a very high percentage shape. The question over here is, what changed? What changed from the times of the Gomorrah down to our present day time where you're getting a very small percentage of kosher? So there's a Rashal in Beitza that clearly says the animals changed. The animals, the days of Chazal, rove that were kosher, and the percentage of trafes has gotten worse and worse over the years. And that's why the days of Chazal there's no obligation to check lungs, and in our days there is no obligation to check lungs. From the times of Rashal on, so the last 100 years, where the animals become very commercialized, and the animal today is not a really, maybe not a natural product, a natural animal the way people think it is. It's an animal which is being raised and engineered for the sake of the consumer. Which means the consumer is running the beef industry today. The consumer has decided that they want that very soft meat, and they want to have fatty meat, barbelized. So the industry is figuring out a way of feeding animals and keeping them docile and not active to make the consumer happy. So the percentage from the days of, from 200 years ago, even up to present day, I've seen myself in the last 7-8 years, the percentage of kosher going down and down and down. Every year is getting worse and worse. But down to today, in an average beef slaughter, you're going to end up with 25 or 30% kosher. Now there is an explanation according to Pichasius. Bnei Sassar explains it, that a behema is a nitzatz, that has to be mavur. And since we're in Ikhma the Mashiach of a chutzpah yaski, he explains chutzpah to mean a davar ra, something bad and not permissible. He said that's going to be misgabar and put in Ikhma the Mashiach. That's why the days of Chazal, as a lot of places we are, and the generations were not at a lower level, most of the kosher. As opposed to today, there's very few babies left to be before. That's why his explanation why today we're seeing that there's a very small amount of kosher. So now, where I want to get to an explanation of what I was trying to explain in the beginning. The first thing we've seen is that the percentage of kosher is coming down. Along with that means the percentage of behuder animals or behuder is also coming down. Everything is dropping. The other aspect, which we have to keep in mind, is that Jews are polarizing. 40, 50 years ago, there was conservative reform Jews are still eating kosher. Today, that market, the market for regular kosher meat, is almost non-existent. The people that are eating kosher wants to be more bolder. So we're going these two directions. What it creates in the market is there's a very high demand for bolder meat, and there's almost no demand for meat which is less bolder. So before I explain exactly what today the marketing terms are of different types of meat, we have a lot of different marketing terms. I'm gonna explain exactly how an animal becomes less or more bolder. So we know from Dina de Gomorrah that a sirka, which is a dish on the lung, makes the animal not kosher. There's a place of Rashi Tosfos, is it because there's a nakif under that, a nakif with the ray of spray? Is there a nakif under that sirka? Or the sirka will eventually tear and cause a nakif? Two opinions. So Chazal saw that there was a way to be mavar if something was really a sirka, and if there really was a hole underneath. And there's different methodology which is used over the generations. So I'm going to start from the beginning, back to the days of the goyim, all the way to the present generation, explaining all the different ways of getting off the sirka, and then we're going to get to the marketing terms. The first way method, does everybody know what a sirka is, first of all?
No. No reason.
Okay. The lung is has lobes, shaped with lobes, and the sirh is adhesion from one part of the lung to the other part of the lung, which is not a natural adhesion, or it's adhesion from the lung to the rib cavity. And that adhesion is, we are choishish that the reason that adhesion came is because there's liquids trying to escape from the lung, and they're escaping through the sirha. And underneath that sirha, there's a hole in the lung, and that makes the animal trach. That's what a sirha is, and that is the main aspect for checking the lungs today. In the days of the Goyim, they had a concept called the nua. The nua means shaking the lung. The idea of shaking the lung is based on a scientific fact that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, which means like this. If I shake the lung, the assumption was that the sirha came from the lung and got stuck to the rib cage, then it was straight. If the sirha started the rib cage and got stuck to the lung, then that's kosher. That's not something coming from the lung, just the lung just happened to be in the way again. The sirha got attached to it. So the days of going they would shake a lung, was called the nua. Basically, it talks about a lot. And they would see which end of the sirha broke off. If the end of the sirha broke off from the rib cage, that means it started in the lung and that was a real sirha. And if it broke off from the lung, that means the stronger connection was the rib cage and that was not a real sirha. They made it kosher. So today we don't have a good use in that. And that is a completely lost art today, the nua. Later in the days of the Rishonim of Rosh Chodesh, they had another method taking off a sirha called Biuch V'Mishmush. This is really going to be the earliest mention of our terminal based Yoris of Leeds. The concept of Biuch V'Mishmush was that if you took a sirha and you rolled it with your fingers and it came off, then it really wasn't a sirha. That's a sign that there's no hole in the lung. The Rashba says you're a deal of Makos Reifus if you do that, and the Makabar took on Yeshita, and the Ramon took on Yeshita portions would be more lenient at certain times you're allowed to make the meal of Mishmash. That was the original focus by the Makabar and Ramon that made the meal of Mishmash. The meal of Mishmash today is also lost art. Nobody's doing it. That's the middle that the whole nucleus between Machaber and Ma today is not Nogeir. It's Nogeir that draws the couple's heart, you want to get an understanding of what they did, how they took off 77 years ago, it gives you a little bit of understanding, but it's not Nogeir of Isaac today. Later, about 200 years ago, another method of getting off circa was started, and that was called Kalipa Circus, where they would take a circa and break it up into four or five different pieces and get the whole circa off, and if it didn't bubble underneath, they assumed the lung was kosher. And then there's another concept of sirha shirha yorik lacharyad, where you took a sirha and you peeled it off the lung in one direction, and there's some according you call that kalap. So now let's get to the vice over here. It's a very important issue to remember what the Kuna just mentioned about the polarization of the consumer. So when I got into where I started, let's see, go even back 80, 90 years ago in this country. If somebody shepherds the sheep in this country, there was one term. It was either kosher or not kosher. Inside that term kosher, you had lungs are watered, animals are watered, animals are less watered. But everything was called kosher. The consumer was not demanding anything else. The consumer was happy to get a kosher piece of meat as opposed to non-kosher meat, and that was enough. Let's say about the time of World War II, more again, the procedural oil started coming into the New York area, in the United States. They wanted an animal swarm odor. Because in those years, animals, rather the kosher, included animals that were not odor. Because the method of getting off circus was either through Biuch Mishmush or Klipas circus. The Shochtim in those generations were using any method they could to make the animal kosher. And a group of people came and started coming to this country and wanted something more kosher. So the terminology of Kalat came into appearance. The terminology of Kalat, so they already started making a separation into the lungs. There was a lung was more kosher, it was called a Kalat. And a lung was less kosher, it was called a kosher. Approximately 40 years ago, I'm in the street 41 years ago, and there was the turbate shoes was almost never used then. It was maybe used for your feet. Around that time, the meat started to be sold as base choice meat. There was this concept of base choice meat. And really, this term base choice, called base choice meat, really has no connection with Joseph Cairo. It's no connection. There's no connection. It was a name that was picked out because there was a voice from Robert Ramah about a method getting off circus. It was a term, the industry started using this term base choice. So now we're going to have three levels of base choice. We have three levels of poultry. We have the base choice, which is more deliberate, and the glut, and the regular poultry. But again, this base choice of meat is no connection to this place from Harvard Law of Miyakamishmush. It was a term that the industry used. As years went on, but more and more people, not just farming, more and more people start asking for base choice of meat. So what I see in the industry is the percentage of base choice of meat that I had 40 years ago is much, much less than what we have today. And the name is not getting better, getting worse.
What is the basis nowadays?
So you're asking a very good question, but I'll explain why it's very hard to answer. If you're dealing with terms that have an actual meaning in Shulchan Aruch or in the dictionary, apple and orange, and apple is an apple, and orange is an orange, and a pine is a pineapple, then I can tell you exactly what you're doing. You're dealing with terms that have no connection to Shulchan Aruch, and a company can put this marketing term on any product they want, then it's really telling you the company. And a company can mark their order. It depends where their color point is. What they can make an arbitrary color point and say 80% of meats are base choices and the other 20 are cut. Or they can say only 20% of meats are base choices. Because the meat itself is the meat, the term base choices has no connection to meat. There's no meaning. It's a meaningless term. If I claim I'm selling you an apple, I really sell you orange, you can sue me. Because that's false advertising. I can't sell orange juice in place of apple juice because it's a term with exact meaning. Here we're dealing with terms that have no meaning, have no connection to meaning. What's that? No connection. Neo-Commissions is a lost art. There was a person who was a Shemit Rabbi Tites about 55 years ago, and he knew what a Neo-Commissions, and that was it.
What is it?
Klipasir is something the Bishop Shimon talked about. It was probably even a bigger clue than Neo-Commissions, but they took the Sircha and broke it up into a whole bunch of little pieces, and if they got it off completely, and the lung was on the box, they would make that lung kosher. The Kalipa surface is done today. So now we have so far three levels of here. But now there's a different problem now. There's a different problem. The market for the kosher is not here. So the percentage of kosher dropping down and down. So some people have this idea that if you shut the goyish plant, it doesn't matter how many kosher you make. Which is not true. People think that since I've shut my boy, I can take whatever I want. I'm not under pressure to make kosher, which is not true. Because the plants that are geared today for kosher are not competitive in the industry. A plant that's not kosher is to be slaughtering 5,000 apples a day. Any plant which is geared for kosher has to be doing 500 or less animals per day in order to make kosher, to be set up for kosher. So there's no way that plant can compete with large plants. The only way it can compete is that they have a niche market that a certain percentage of the meter can be sold as kosher. So if you're going into a plant and you're bringing all these senior guys with the payas down to these, you're drinking a cup and you're buying 2% of the animals, you're out the door. The plant, no kosher plant is going to keep you if you're only taking 2% of the animals. So this concept that the shkitas, since they're working in kosher plants, is not under pressure to pay kosher is not true. As more the percentages come down, the less the plant is likely to keep you, and the less that plant is likely to stay existing. Because any plant that's killing 500 animals a day or less and does not have a niche market is going backward. So the overall percentages of kosher today are, let's say, I'm just trying to give you a ballpark figure. If I'm including the base choice and the glut and the kosher together, it can reach 30% in the United States.
To 30? 30.
in a good thing.
Now there's another issue that I want to mention on this.
At a time where there are legal requirements to take care of the animals, there are limits on how many animals you have per acre, on what foods required to give the animals in order to make the food ready. And they gave medications to the animals in order to help them recover, electrolytes, things that were not even, they didn't know how to spell that in Europe. How is the expectation that there are fewer kosher animals today and animals are being kept in much better situations than they ever were?
Okay, so I'm personally not convinced there's much better conditions. The first thing I want to mention was the civil parasha. There's two main causes today of syrupus. One cause the civil parasha mentions is that the animals are not eating all the healthy foods, which they cannot digest. And the other one is that it's a pneumonia-related issue, where they're getting, you left out the rain, they're getting cold. So going to this first issue over here, in order to keep you, I don't mean you specifically, I mean the consumer happy, they want to keep these animals docile, because the meat you're eating is the animal's muscles. The more the animal's exercising, the tougher the beast is going to be. The animals that are in the United States are being fed corn. The bovine, the animals cannot digest corn. Animals get sick from eating corn. The main reason why it's such a low percentage of kosher today is because of the feed. And because the animal is inactive. It's leading an unhealthy lifestyle. It's basically a coil in your mouth, so you're not fetching bait, not doing anything, just stressing. As opposed to you go to South America, there's a lot of countries that are feeding animal grass, the percentage of kosher is much higher. So I'm not really convinced that it could be we create a lot more sicknesses, we have a lot more antibiotics to help cure these sicknesses. That could be. But that's something we did. That's something we did in order to repair it. But I'm not really convinced that the animals are leading a better lifestyle. You do see it. It's definitely food. It's the main cause today is with the animals, and you have so much non-kosher, is because of the feed. So what happens now with the regular kosher? There's no market for it. So there's a few options over here. Just stop making regular kosher, then your percentage drop down even more. And the meat's going to go up in price, and it's quite possible that plant will be out the door, the plant will be back there. The certain trend in the industry today is that there are certain companies that are taking the meat that used to be called regular kosher, calling that glut, and the meat that used to be called glut, they're calling it decisive, and the meat that used to be called decisive is now called chalak or shayish means marble. Anybody knows where shayish is mentioned in the Torah?
Anybody know?
Megillah.
Very good. Surah Zachashverish. In Surah Zachashverish, they had shayish. The Malbim says sheish means shayish. So if you want to get real shayish, that's where they had it. And the real base, if you want to find a real base, there's a sefer over here called the Tur with a parish on it, a parish one side of the base, and the bottom, that's the real base. All these other terms today is marketing terms. And the base choice is probably the best marketing term there is. There's nothing better than marketing with base choice. Want to know why? Anybody know why? Not exactly what I had in mind. Typically, a rubber muxer, somebody would use somebody's name on your product, he will charge you at the end of the year for giving a stock of charging $50,000, $80,000, whatever he feels his name is worth, whatever you're agreeable to pay. Joseph Cairo, if you write out a check for Joseph Cairo at the end of the year for using his name, he ain't cashing. That money's sitting in your bags. In English, you call it a freebie. So here you have a term which is meaningless because the voice of Kabbalah Rabbah is non-existent. And I can call this wall a Kalamazoo. If you disagree, if you agree, it's irrelevant. It's a meaningless term. The company can use it freely, and the companies know that the consumer is interested in seeing that label on the product. So why not?
Who decides, the company or the hashkacha?
In many cases, the company itself, the rabbi realizes the term is meaningless. And so he's not really getting involved in their methods of selling their meat. So the company's going to put it on. I ordered a store about 20 years ago. We bought a pallet of meat, and it was glut. And we complained to the company that we ordered base choice. We sent it back.
I remember the exact same label. The pallet came back a few days later with patients and labels on it. Exact same ballerine. So it's a cool blessed over there. Someone on the loading dock blessed the meat. Now what you do find, so this gather, this demarcation, what you call basis, what you call shy, what you call blood, is really not the same in every company. But what you will find in the companies is that if a company has a product that's more, that they feel is more bewildered, and it usually is, they will call that basis. If there's something that's less bewildered, they will call blood. What is the breakout point? That's every company's going to be different. That's totally up to the company. So if you have one specific company where they're selling two products, one product they're calling Beishoizen, and the one we're calling Lot, then that one that's called Beishoizen is more bored, even though it has no connection to Beishoizen. The show, there's many showcases today where you go into a store, and you see that the whole showcase is Beishoizen. So what does that mean? That should be a red flag to somebody.
Is there a category for no cereal at all?
The category for something completely, completely clean is a new category which started about 7-8 years ago. The Hasidim call it Horuk, and the non-Hasidim call it Shayish. I don't know if that's true in Chicago, because it could be you guys are behind a little bit here in the cutting edge from Kaiser. I don't know if it's free Chicago or not, but it's definitely New York area. That marketing term. Any questions?
Is it the same as Eretz Yisrael?
So in Eretz Yisrael, most of the Israeli meats are not coming from Eretz Yisrael, they're coming from South America. So the Rabbanut itself will accept animals that have Beglik with Sirkus on it. To the best of my knowledge, the Hayim Shashkakas will not accept it. It could be that's changed over the years, percentage of kosher comes out, possibly. They've changed, I don't know, but to the best of my knowledge, they're not going to be using animals making the Klippusir. The Klippusir is probably a bigger cooler than the meal from Mishbush, and it's something that Machaber didn't even mention, because that method was not around in his time. In the times of Machaber, the method getting off the circle was the meal from Mishbush. The Klippusir was something which was invented or discovered 300 years later.
So bacteria is not new.
What's that? Well, you
it's not the number of circles, the size of the circles.
It's not so much the number of the circles, it's how heavy the circle is. In other words, a circle you can see there's no connection to the lung, you can just peel off very easily, that's how likely it's going to make that most rate. That's something that's very plus right now, that's probably a definitely an edible product. The circles that are much harder to get off, and you have to break them up into pieces, you have to roll them, that's a tool to get them off all the animal kosher. What's that?
They're not doing
up until 15 years ago, anytime you clean companies would call it kosher. But there's definitely a trend in the industry. I know three specific Ashkakas that are doing, which will go on name, because I'm not here to sell or rent Ashkakas. I know three specific Ashkakas that will take a cleave of circus and call it blood. And what used to be called blood will be marked as Beishoizen. And okay. What used to be called Beishoizen will be marked as Holok.
So Beishoizen doesn't have to use circles according to these companies? Or?
What's that? Typically, if you see the marketing, if you see the term "base Joseph" on it, they will not be doing clinical service on it. Because somebody do clinical service, they can put it, they can downgrade and call it blood. Even though that's, it's a debatable term, but again, blood just means smooth. This paper is also very smooth, so it's not, that's just what the term means. A lot of color is also.
Is there any downgrade of base yosef? If you eat glad, you always eat base yosef, or some people eat glad, but not base yosef.
You're talking about what people eat?
Is it always better?
People don't know what they eat. The only thing a person knows is the label on the package. What you're getting, you have no way of knowing. If you want to buy a car, you can get consumer reports, you can find out exactly what you're getting. How the miles per gallon, how reliable, et cetera, et cetera. You can find every aspect of this car. A piece of meat, you as a consumer have no way of knowing what you're eating. The only thing maybe you're going to hear something in the Bigfoot, which is a rumor that was passed on from one person to another person. Started off 75 people to go back and started with the owner of the company himself, put out the rumor. That's the best case scenario. Part of a Sephardic Jew today is that it should have the word Pesach on the package. And that anybody knows.
So what would you recommend to the average consumer? It sounds very confusing for the average consumer.
What's that?
What are we supposed to do as an average consumer going to the store? When you're telling me that everything is all the same, we have no
idea. No, it's not all the same. No. There are lungs that are more odor, there are lungs less odor, yes.
You're saying the packaging is never going to tell me that.
The packaging is not going to tell you that unless you see in one showcase one company with two different labels, something that they're calling Beisheis, something like that, then you probably want to stay clear of the glut and don't need the Beisheis. Even though it has no connection to the Joseph Carter.
So this is all based on market
engagement.
Every time
I'm saying,
you're
saying,
this is based on market, social engagement, right? Market. And every time you say keep your system, everybody you're related to your market has
made. I don't hear you that well, sorry. Speak up.
If this is based on society forcing the market to make more Beisheis, put more labels that say Beisheis, right? As opposed to me being actually.
The marketing is the marketing interest in one thing, selling a product. Whatever they need to do to sell the product, that's what they'll do.
Right. So you're telling people that if Beisheis is more wondrous, everybody here is not saying you go out and only Beisheis.
If
they have to make more meat that is not.
If you have a company that has two separate labels, they're selling blood here, they say it, then the base is going to be more loaded. But if they're calling every base race, it's just a little soft up, they're going to be more loaded.
But everybody here goes out and just buys base now. So next week, they have to put more base labels on because they have all the glass sitting on the shelf, somebody's buying it, and only base. So every time we hear about it, right, aren't we?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Judaism, we're polarizing. We're getting firmer, and the fryer getting our, leaving the fold. So that's exactly what the issue is. If you would not be looking for base oils, neither would they be on the shelf. You're running the business, nobody else. You're running the whole industry. The whole industry is run by you. Kosher beef industry.
How do we get any meat?
How do what?
How does the average person decide that they're getting meat? If you're looking at labels that you're eating, that
means you're eating. I don't know any companies that are going to sell you. I don't know any companies today that are going to take trade for meat and sell this kosher. So you're relying on something that's a little bit more lean, that's all.
You're not saying that the less smothered meat is trade.
No, I'm not saying it's trade. They have, these companies have what you like, but you're buying, you might just buy a product, which is less smothered. And it's not necessary. You can check it under a microscope and see exactly what you get. You can't. No, definitely not. It's a very good question. If you read through responses, Shilas and Shuv 100 years ago, there's a Sada Shabbat, all the Shilas they had about kosher babies, there's a Sada Shabbat, the bottom line, which is the bottom line, every single Jew is exactly the bottom line. What was the bottom line was, the Yiddish feet, that name had to be kosher. They schlepped the sefer this way, they schlepped it that way, this rabbi didn't like it, they took it to another rabbi, went to this rabbi, but the bottom line, the animal had to be kosher. So it's definitely not any worse what they had in Europe. That's for sure not. And not only that, in facetious circles, you can mark a meat by telling the consumer that this is what your Zayde ate. That is marketable. Not some marketable, big time marketable. If you can convince a facetious consumer that his elder Zayda in Hungary ate this piece of meat, done deal. Either Zayda had to eat because he was a shas of cotton, he didn't have this, he didn't have any options. That's not an issue. Don't confuse him with the facts. I don't know if Zayda did. The Zayda did it, I do it later. That's a marketable term in the facetious world. I live with it in class, it's a disaster. people are totally disconnected to the sea as facts of life. They're just living in a world of, you know, what they did 100 years ago. I live with it, I suffer with it in schlock houses. I work the whole week in schlock houses. I do a lot of freelance work. I work in every single chicken soup lab in space. Every day.
What do you
eat? I personally eat only grass-fed cattle. Because the nutritional value of the corn-fed cattle is very low. The grass-fed cattle is much higher. So there's a place in Binghamton, New York, where they shut grass-fed cattle. There's another place in Amish country that I work. I go to Amish country quite a bit to work, where they shut the grass-fed cattle raised by the Amish. Fish value is much higher. I'm involved with the sheep. I see what's going on. Those are the things I eat. That's for health reasons.
The percent kosher without circus is definitely higher in those.
Yes.
Like South America.
Yeah. South America has a different issue of ruin and bloat, but we don't have too much. Where the stomach of the animal is bloating up with gases. In order to release the gases, the farmer will very often poke a hole in the stomach to release the gas. That's very common. It's getting less, but it is common in South America. We don't have that. We have a very low percentage in the States, and in South America is quite high.
South America needs more or less of that.
More what?
More or less of that as a whole.
In general, you have a higher percentage of kosher. It's hard for me to tell you to answer that question. You've got to see really specific plant in South America compared to American plant, which is more wooded. It's very hard for me to answer that question. Do you have an issue of a rumen bloat down there that you don't have?
Is rumen bloat, the main tree rumen bloat, is that tree for
100%? That, according to most poisons, can make the animal straight, right? Yes.
But isn't
there are methods of releasing the gas with the propeller that will not make a tree. It depends on what stage you catch the problem and how they're going to deal with it. But I have been told that the percentage that I've come down with, farmers are given incentives not to give them different fees and not to avoid this issue.
How do you avoid
the
thing that's like common cattle work?
What's that?
A massive percentage of the cows have this, even in America.
Rumen bloat?
They make rumen bloat plugs on Amazon you can buy it, it's so common.
Percentage of this country are less than 1%. Well, sheep's not any different. The only big difference you can have with bob sheep, the shaker hopefully will be a bob sheep. That's quite it. They're not any better or any worse than any other company. Okay, we go on to the chickens. Chickens, I brought a bag of samples afterwards. That's going to be a little bit messy, but we'll start off with the shirt and leave the samples for the end. Okay. So for the last 9 years, I've been working on a safer called a Frankenstein sheep of me, which I have there on the back table. And in my safer app is an agenda. I'm going to explain this agenda over here because this is the explanation of giving the shirt is basically. Almost everything will be explained to sure. The things that these I write about the safer. My agenda is to show how a chicken from 200 years ago that was running around your yard, eating whatever it could find, was converted into a piece of plastic. That's the agenda. And because it was converted into a piece of plastic, and I explained exactly what was done in the industry this chicken, because it was converted to what it is today, a commercialized chicken, that is causing all our traitorous problems we have today with chickens. So let's go back to the chicken that was living in your backyard in the European chicken. The main, if you want to get a good lesson in history, you read Shadows and Shoes. Good historical lesson, gives you an idea of what was going on in that generation. The main Shadows and Shoes of chickens, up until 100 years ago, there's at least 60 shilas, and each is two issues. One was a a nail inside the hook, that the chicken had a nail got stuck in its fork one, made a nape in it. And the other is that there's wild animals coming into your flock, and they were dorsal. Because all felt that the wild animals had a certain hairs in their claws, and they stuck their claws into the animal, that would render the chicken non-kosher. That was two main things. Those two issues today are complete drosha kabbalistic. I personally worked with Platt about 42 years ago, where the Rav Ashi was still European, and he felt that we had to check all the corpus, so the Erev Mashiach that was fetching every kupak. So I personally fetched 5 million kupakas in the empire, and I, how many nails do you think I found? Zero. So that's the nails of corpus is Rosh Hashanah. So the chicken of 150 years ago was one breed of chicken, which is a very important food. It was one breed of chicken raised both for meat and both for chickens. Both for meat and both for eggs. What that translates into is that when the chicken was you don't have one male for every female. You could have one male with 10 females. So when the chick was born, the males that grew, they weren't able to sex chickens at day one. The males grew up, and those males became meat chickens, and the females were kept for egg layers. Now the egg layer, once the production dropped off, it also became a meat chicken. It was also slaughtered and shut it for meat. First invention which really started changing around the industry is that in the olden days a chicken would give birth, let's say 4 or 5, 6 eggs would hatch them, and then you're limited in what you could do with it. It's only 5 eggs, they hatch them. About 108 years ago, an incubator was invented. An incubator was a method of hatching 1,000 chickens. So the industry started moving towards incubating eggs. Now we have a lot of an incubator where there's to be thousands of chickens hatching. What followed out of this incubator was the idea of setting up chicken coops. Because now we have 1,000 eggs hatching, and we can't just raise them in your backyard. We're going to put in a coop. But the coop itself poses problems because the chicken. He was getting certain vitamins from sunlight, and other vitamins was getting out in the yard. So that the beginning, the chicken coops were not successful because they're not getting the proper vitamin. Vitamin D was discovered, and they started raising chickens in coops. Then, about 90 years ago, there was an invention in Japan which was to figure out a way of sexing chicken at day one. So it used to be I had to raise all these egg-laying chickens still a little older and then make them into meat chickens. Now, once I could sex them when they're day one, which is males and females, I didn't have to bother raising this chicken, which I'm going to kill anyways. I could keep only the females and kill all the males, which is something we just done today. The egg layer, the chicks that are hatching, these chickens eventually become egg layers, so the males are killed when day one. Once they did that, there was a shortage of meat chickens. So the industry went into broke up into two completely different products, completely different breeds. The industry started focusing on one specific breed of chickens, which would be very good for laying eggs, because like the eggs here, they weren't interested in the meat chicken. And the other aspect that they worked on was a meat laying. It was a chicken which is going to be used only for meat. This is something the industry turned into. About 150 years ago, there was a chicken that was brought in from Cochin in China, which was a very heavy chicken that voices in those times spoke about it. Most Achoyim said that in Masora. It was the plus of this chicken was it was very lazy, it was very large. The plus, anybody knows the plus being very lazy? It doesn't burn your calories. You can feed it 2 pounds of feed. And you produce 1 pound of chicken, stop burning up all your calories. So that was introduced. Basically, at that time, most of the coin you said was, it didn't have a sword, eventually became mixed in. Everybody was eating was already became accepted that this chicken is going to be edible in Tarufus. Sicknesses develop because now you have thousands of chickens being raised in coop. And in order to combat the sicknesses, a lot of vaccines were introduced. Another change in the industry was in the old days, a person wanted to preserve something, they had an ice box. But a person drove around the truck, delivered ice, and we put it in the box. And that's how you kept thinking. The idea of refrigeration. Refrigerated trucks didn't exist. Once refrigerated trucks came in, then you had an option of freezing things and then refrigerating and selling them across the country. All these aspects led to a commercialization of the chicken. About 1945, a company called A&P, who was trying to figure out a way to get the chickens to grow as fast as possible, use as little food as possible, they put out a competition. Called the Chicken of Tomorrow, and they gave all the farmers an option of producing a chicken which could be grow very fast and eat very little. The chickens that were winning in this competition were the chicken coming from an Asian fighting bird called a Malay, which was eventually produced a Cornish chicken, which is what the industry changed over about 50 years ago to produce a chicken which we have today, which is called the Rock Cornish. The Rock Cornish was half of Morocco, which was a European chicken mixed in with the breed from Cochin. That itself had a shadow of sore on it. And the new chicken which came in, which the Rabbana never really spoke about it, but was not already in plants, is the Cochin chicken. The Cochin chicken at that time did not have a sore. It's something that's just recently come to the forefront of the sore of these chickens. This chicken was raised, it became a completely patented item. The idea of raising chickens in your backyard stopped completely. And the downside of that is that the chicken you had in your backyard 150 years ago was a direct descendant of the chicken that your great-great-grandfather had. So you saw a continuation of the flock. Today, the chickens, this raw Cornish, which is a commercialized chicken being used all over the world, is being produced by a few large companies. It's a patented item. You cannot buy chicks from this company and reproduce them on your own. So every flock you're getting is a very different production. The flock that you're getting may be connected to the flock you bought from 5 years ago. It may not be. It's up to date. They're engineering, they're tweaking it. The direction they're tweaking this chicken is a three or four different ways of tweaking it. One way they're tweaking this chicken is to be growing as fast as possible. So I show this in this book in 1925, a chicken took about 112 days to reach 2.5 pounds. And today, our chickens today are reaching 5 pounds in 36 days. So the work on the chicken is on the speed of the growth. That's one thing. The next thing which is being worked on is the food conversion ratio. We just touched on that. Everyone knows what a food conversion ratio is? Food conversion ratio is how many pounds of feed you need to produce 1 pound of chicken meat. That's every farmer's bottom line. And what it's really going to be telling you is tweaking this chicken that should be lazy. Because if your chicken's running around, you're basically sending your chicken to the gym. You're paying for your chicken to go to the gym. You're not gaining, just burning up your calories. So that used to be slightly under 5, now it's down to about 0.7. The third thing the industry is working on is the proportion of breast meat to leg meat. The money in the chickens is the breast meat side, the kosher side, the non-kosher. And the more, the chicken ratio of breast meat to leg meat just changes every year. Every year there's more breast meat, less leg meat. You don't notice because it's very small amounts. But if you look at the picture of the chicken today and the chicken of 50 years ago, you see the difference. It's at the point today where a turkey, for example, cannot mate in a natural way. All turkeys there are reproduced with artificial insemination. Because the rest of the turkey is so large, they cannot get close enough to the female to mate. They've engineered the breast to be so large, it just can't get close enough.
So, another accomplishment
of the industry is if you read from Charles the Chief 100 years ago, you see that chicken was a specialty item. You had a chicken for young people, it was a big deal. Through this lowering the food conversion ratio and making it grow faster and raising chickens in large coops where every chicken today has 0.8 fiber square foot to grow in, all these things were successfully done is to lower the price of chickens. Chicken today, everybody's eating chicken. Chicken today became a staple item. That is another accomplishment in the industry that they've done over the last 200 years. All of these issues that I'm explaining over here have an effect on kashrus. Again, kashrus, the issue of 20 years ago, the nails and the wild animals are non-existent. All the issues that I mentioned above have a direct effect on kashrus. In my safer, I'm trying to document, starting off with halacha, and start explaining to you that starting off with halacha is showing how every single treatise we have today is because of the fact that we've made our chicken with a piece of plastic, we commercialize this chicken. It's one breed of chicken we use all over the world, and the commercialization of the chicken causes a whole list of kashrus issues. I brought today a lot of samples from KJ Poultry of different type of drapers that were completely non-existent 50 years ago, even 100 years ago. And today, there are flocks that are sometimes 90% drake, there are flocks 20% drake. Every flock is different. So if you're interested in seeing them, I can lay some of these things out.
Let's first see
if you have any questions for me. Yes?
You have to speak up. I have
a
gauge, the hard hearing.
There was a time about 20 years ago when bison
I wouldn't say that it became very popular. I don't remember any time in the Jewish world that a large percent of people were eating bison. I don't even the days when it was being shechted, it was shechted 30 babies a week, 40 babies a week. It's going to be a healthier item. It's a more natural.
There's some chicken companies that don't say that rich chickens are raised on the range outside and breast, is that the least?
Okay, so first of all, chickens don't eat grass. They will eat grass, but they don't need it. It's unlike a beef, they can digest protein. Chickens are typically eating bugs, and that aspect they're very different than beef. They cannot digest protein, chicken can. So the fact that it's grass fed is not a big deal for beef. It doesn't really mean too much. It's a nice herb. It's a very nice herb for beef.
Free range.
Free range. So there was a sickness industry called reovirus, which affected some of the eating in this country. I was very much involved. I was one of I found it in the plant, and in the early years we had. Percentage of 40% trace on it, 80% trace. I was contracted by a lot of schlockhouses to go into farms in Amish country to get an idea what percentage of trace is going to find in this farm before they bought the flock. So some of the farms they used to go to were organic chickens. The organic chicken is a little bit different than the regular. I'm going to just get to your free range in a second. The organic chicken is a little bit different in the fact that it has, first of all, 1 square foot of living area as opposed to the commercial chicken has 0.85, but the other, the big option I want to tell you about is the organic chicken has an option, legally you have to give it an option free range, which means that inside the coop, you have to picture this coop is packed in chickens, There are two doors that are open, and outside those doors is a fenced-off area, so the chicken has an option of going out that door and ranging around, roaming around, maybe trying to catch a bug. I used to go to farms like that, so with these farms I went to, how many chickens do you think were inside and how many were outside? Zero. You want to know why? Because it's the exact same breed of chicken, and it's engineered to thresh, and it thresh very well. It's really a big thresher. That's what it's engineered to do. That's what the industry works on making. Eat as much as it could possibly digest. It's obese. And the food is inside. Outside, there are some bugs, but you gotta catch them. And the chickens, our chicken has a 5-week warranty on it. What does it mean? If you buy a watch with a 6-week warranty on it, what does that tell you? But probably after 6 weeks, it's not gonna be around. So our chickens have a 5-week warranty. If our chickens would go to the age of 7 weeks, they're very prone to heart attacks. Very common is chickens that are 6 weeks old, 7 weeks old, they drop dead for heart attack. The reason is that they're obese. They're basically a little baby that weighs 300 pounds. They're being pressing, pressing, pressing. So in order to catch this bug, they have to chase it. There's a possibility they get a heart attack in the meantime. There was not one chicken outside. There were some males. The male is typically more aggressive than people. There were some males that were looking out the door just to see what's going on, but they weren't going outside. So, and what else did you mention? Grass-fed free range, what else? The free range, yeah. It's economically, it's not realistic to have chickens running around the yard and have to go catch them. You got wild animals coming. A chicken like that would be 5 times the price of a regular chicken. I have been to Amish farms where they raise what they call a pasture raised chicken, which you think is running around the yard. What it is basically is they're setting up a tent in the field. They're packing in the chickens. And they harvest that crop when they harvest it in 5 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever the time is. It's a regular commercial raised chicken, just like the chicken you're eating, but it's growing on the grass. An intent. When they take them out to harvest them, to slaughter them, they just move the tent somewhere else. They don't clean up that area. But that chicken can be marketed as a pasture-raised, free-range chicken. But it's just basically it's packed in just like a regular chicken. Now, people might think this is start all fine. The chicken, that the commercial chicken has 0.85 square feet, it's fine with it. It doesn't need any more of that. It's not interested in running around. It's packed well as well. It's just getting access to food. That's its only interest.
Okay, yeah.
Are most chickens chickens?
No. Today, typically, we do have a little trade with this industry. We started getting worse and worse over the last couple of years. That's delivers. And that's going to be a big factor that we're going to get to it when we shoot the samples. But typically today, a plant will shed, they'll get 97-98% culture, 97-95% culture. Unless there's a virus growing in the industry, real virus, which affects tendons, then you could have 90% faith.
So even though they can't last past 7 weeks, they're going to have a heart attack. That doesn't make them a trait, though.
No. In order to make something trait, it has to have some aspect of its body, which chazal or kovayat's trait is. The aspect of something an animal living in here is a bureau and a suffix trait for it. If you have an animal which is a suffix trait for it, and you want to know if it's a trait or not, and you let it live for a year, you assume it was a kosher out of it. But the fact that it can only live 7 weeks does not make it a trait or not. What we were getting today in the industry, I'm going to show you some examples, is liver issues. The liver is a blood filter, which means that the animal, if there's sicknesses in the chicken, the liver will filter out of the blood. Because it's filtering sickness out of the blood, the liver itself starts rotting. And that is something which is the last couple started about 50 years ago, and it gets worse and worse every year. And I've seen flocks that are 25% trained just because of the livers. If a liver is rotten, it's considered like it's not here, it's an E. coli incumbent. E. coli incumbent is stripped.
Are shock passes checking livers?
What's that?
Are shock passes checking livers?
So I personally only go to 2 schlock houses on a regular basis. I go to other ones that once every few years. The 2 schlocks they go on a regular basis are Curaciol and a plant called Astora, which used to be called Mahadri, and it's in Red, Pennsylvania. both of those plants are checking livers. And what their system is, in KJ, for example, they have three workers, non-Jewish workers, trained to pull all these fake chickens off the line, even before they even reach here. And they do a pretty good job of it, too. The store is also checking livers. What they're doing in other companies, I can find out very easily, but I don't have any, right today I don't have any need to know what other companies do, but if I wanted to know, I could find it very easy if they're aware of it. But again, something new to me, especially came to the forefront a few years ago, because up until 2 years ago, the USDA was throwing out the whole chicken. There's a little bit of change in their policy where they decide only the liver's a problem, and they're letting it reach the machine. So we really put this whole issue came on the table and not like KJ about 2 years ago. Because after then the USDA was throwing out the whole chicken. Now they have to deal with it.
Did someone say that the heavy breast put stress on their knees and messed up the tendons?
Right, so the heavy breast means that you have, relative to the size of chicken, you have very weak legs. So in the way of taking chickens out of a coop today is most plants are still doing it. They'll have a tractor trailer pull up alongside the coop, let workers go inside the coop, grab three chickens in each hand, carry them outside, put them in coops onto the truck. In order to do this as fast as possible, they want to get three chickens each hand. If you get three chickens each hand, they're only grabbing one leg. They're not grabbing two legs. So when you pick up a chicken with one leg, and the leg is weak, and the breast is heavy, and you give it a jerk up, that leg dislocates. It doesn't usually dislocate completely, but it becomes loose and bloody. That is an issue which the heavier the chicken is, the older the chicken is, let's say difference between 35 days and 38 days, the percentage of dislocated legs is much higher. And I have brought some examples today of dislocated legs, but there's a new issue today that the leg is dislocated in a way it didn't do, the way it didn't dislocate 100 years ago because of the age of the chicken. And that's also something I want to show.
Does that make a trafe?
It's a big corner to call a trafe, but most companies today will make these chickens non-covered. But it's a very good corner because in order to make a trafe, the dislocated leg has to have an equal knee, which means there's three little tendons attaching your leg to the body. And in order for that chicken to be trafed and deemed it tomorrow, these knee have to be rotten. So usually this issue of the leg dislocating is happening about 20 hours before the shechita. Because typically they'll unload a coup the night before the shechita, they'll bring to the shlachtos, they'll shut the next day. So it's happening 20 hours. So the leg is dislocating 20 hours before the shechita. It's really not realistic that something's going to rot in 20 hours. It's just totally not realistic. If you'll take a food item and put it outside, in the worst possible conditions, heat, moisture, it's not going to rot in 20 hours. So meat and redeem, well, probably these chickens are kosher. Today they're being made, most plants are making them non-kosher. Because there are some, most plants, if they see it, it's not something which is invisible. In Cajun, in Marshall, they have, and Missouri, they have a special person checking just the coconuts. The other issue with what we're seeing today is tendons are tearing. Tendons, some of the heating that comes forward, makes the chickens right. You see it more in turkey, you see it in chickens also. It could just be the stress on the tendons growing at such a fast speed is causing you to tear without any sickness. You see it a lot more by turkeys. I've seen flocks with 70% torn medium and the animal is perfectly healthy. Just the stress on the leg of growing at such a fast speed causes the tendons to tear. And you see it by chickens also. That's one issue what's causing tendons to tear. And the other issue is sickness called reovirus. Living in a chicken coop where there's no ventilation causes lung issues. Because the chicken 20 years ago was running around your back and are breathing fresh air. Now you have 30,000 chickens inside a coop, 25,000 square feet. Nobody's doing housekeeping. Does anybody understand what housekeeping is? That's your mother who comes around and cleans up your mess. The chickens don't have it, so without any soil, any excrement, which is coming out of them, is sitting in the coop for 5 weeks. So they have all this manure, their own manure in the coop, and they're living on it. And if the coop is very dry, you're going to have a lot of bacteria in this manure, and that bacteria will go in the air, and the chicken will breathe it in. Once chicken breeds bacteria into its lungs, the lung will try to fight off this bacteria. The actual fight itself causes lung tissue to rot. That's we're seeing that today also. So every single flavors issue that we're having today is related to the age of the chicken. There's one more we're just going to explain about that before we show the samples. The chicken has something which is equivalent to our umbilical cord, which means when the chicken is in the egg form, the part, let's say, the white of the egg becomes the food and the yellow becomes the chicken. So the chicken is going to get a nourishment from that food through a little hole in its intestine. And when that chicken is born, the leftover of the egg is still attached to the intestine, and that chicken is supposed to live off this egg for a few days until it figures out how to find food on its own. That's the way the ape should create a chicken, that it could live off the leftover of the egg for a few days, which is still attached to its intestine, for a few days to find food. What's happening today, and that umbilical cord, as the older the chicken gets, the more it will heal up. So when they were shucking 120 years ago, they were shucking chickens of 7 months old, they rarely found any issue with the umbilical cord. Our chickens are 5 weeks old. That umbilical cord didn't have time to heal up, and the chicken is getting food right from day one, so the leftover egg is never eating up. It's eating regular food right from day one. So we're getting issues on the intestines, which they didn't have 150 years ago. The Knei Boisek, who was an Israeli Boisek, writes about the Das Kedoshim, that he just never had chickens that young. The Das Kedoshim once saw one of these intestines, and he didn't know what it was. He was a big shy little boy. Sarah's, what is it? He didn't even know what it was. He never saw it. The chicken 7 months old. The intestines always healed. Our chicken are 5 weeks old. That left over from the umbilical cord is very often not healed up. And that's something which every single company today is checking to make the chicken straight. Sometimes 3-4%. So every single issue we're having today is because of the commercialization of the chicken. Any more questions? Samples? Do you want to put out your plastic?